I'm Brian Kurtz, and I'm a child and adolescent psychiatrist.
Healthy Minds Alliance is an innovative AmeriCorps program managed by Health 360 that engages AmeriCorps members of all ages and backgrounds to meet critical mental health needs in communities served by their host sites. AmeriCorps members serving with the Healthy Minds Alliance receive a stipend during their 10-month service term, and upon completion of their service term, receive an education award which can be used to repay qualified student loans and to pay current educational expenses at eligible institutions of higher education and training programs. If you're interested in becoming an AmeriCorps member or would like information on how your organization could become a host site, please see our show notes for information on how to apply.
Welcome, current, former, future AmeriCorps service members. My name is Michael, and I will be your host for today's Healthy Minds Alliance podcast. And I'm also a currently serving AmeriCorps member. Now, for part of our Mental Health Awareness Month coverage, we're going to change up the format of the show just a little bit. So today, I'm interviewing my friend, Brian, who just also happens to be a child and adolescent psychiatrist with the Cincinnati Children's Hospital. And we're going to talk about some things in the mental health field, and I hope you will enjoy this conversation. So, Brian, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much.
So we've had the opportunity to talk a few other times. We share some other hobbies. Mm-hmm. That's how you and I have met and became friends, at least friendly. And I'm just very appreciative of you giving me some of your time today. So, again, you are a child and adolescent psychiatrist. If you want to give us just really quickly sort of your bona fides, how long you've been in the field, your education, whatever you'd like to share with people.
So let me talk a little bit about the process of becoming a child and adolescent psychiatrist. We're physicians, so we've graduated from medical school after undergraduate. And then we do a residency where we study in my case, psychiatry, and learn how to be a physician that treats mental health conditions in adult patients. And then after that, to do a subspecialty, what's called a fellowship, for 2 years studying, in particular, how to treat children and adolescents and their families. And through the course of the training, we learn about different kinds of conditions that impact children and adolescents, the way those mental health conditions might interact with different medical problems or medical situations as well. And we learn about the treatments that are researched and supported to help children and families that are dealing with mental health symptoms and conditions. Those certainly include psychotherapy, different kinds of modalities of psychotherapy or talk therapy to help with different mental health problems, as well as medication managements when those are useful for addressing different symptoms and conditions. As physicians, we are able to prescribe medications when they're appropriate for children and adolescents who are maybe suffering with mental health conditions.
All right, excellent. Well, you are absolutely the right person to have this conversation with today. Now, obviously, we're talking about mental health in general, but just because of your specialty and the fact that the training that I provide through the AmeriCorps is the Youth Mental Health First Aid, we're going to kind of focus it more on child and adolescent age groups. So, as someone who has been in the practice now for 13 years, very well educated, what has changed recently? Like what do you think people might not know, or maybe there's misinformation? Just like you've got an audience of untold millions of people who listen to this podcast, what would you love for them to know that maybe they don't already?
So I think it might be helpful to start with what I think probably people have a sense of, but maybe don't have a lot of context for how to view it in the overall picture of mental health. And so I think some things to understand is that we are facing a youth mental health crisis right now. And by that, I mean that there are larger than ever numbers of young people, children and adolescents, who are experiencing crises. So not just symptoms of mental health conditions, but symptoms that are impairing enough that they are grossly disrupting their lives, potentially, impacting safety, major aspects of functioning in life, their relationships with their family, their friends, their pursuit of academics and careers and things like that. So we are seeing larger than ever numbers of this. And I think for people who work at all in the spaces where we see children and adolescents, whether that be schools or hospitals, emergency rooms, this is probably something that people are seeing and feeling the impact of. There's also some reflection of it in the media in terms of, you know, newspapers and news organizations reporting a little bit on this as well. So I think we are seeing just large numbers, and the people who are presenting for emergency care are facing challenges that are just more widespread than they have been in the past. The mental health crisis isn't particularly new, but it is getting worse, I would say. And that is just impacting the ability for people to access care. That's a major piece of things as well.
Yeah, we talk about that again, the course that I teach, it's called Youth Mental Health First Aid. And one of the things that we try to do is break down barriers to seeking care. And some people may not know what a care is available, what care they need. Logistics, cost is a lot of those. So I know that COVID, terrible, but one of the things that it did was sort of rewire society to know that, hey, Zoom meetings or virtual meetings are a thing. How has that impacted your role or just psychiatry as a whole? Like, is it helped at all because we have greater access? Is that something that we can take as a positive?
That's a great question. I think the truth is we don't know for sure, but we suspect that there may be some impacts. I think one thing to realize is that there is probably some residual strain on the mental health of our population, both youth as well as parents, certainly schools, you know, basically you name it, in terms of creating challenges to being able to maintain a sense of well-being, maintain your equilibrium in your life. I think if we think about the pandemic that began in 2020 and how disruptive it was to all of our lives, and particularly thinking about how it interfered with some of the normal developmental processes of youth, you know, no matter what age, whether that's going to school and seeing your friends every day there, whether it's participating in activities, whether it's being able to have the kinds of relationships with the caregivers in your lives that feels stable and sustainable, those kinds of things. Those things were all disrupted by the pandemic. And I think we continue to see it's some ripple effects of that in terms of increased rates of anxiety, increased rates of depression. And I think this is not restricted just to youth, but I think it's whenever something like this happens, I think vulnerable groups of individuals and youth are among that are probably affected a bit more prominently than the general population.
Yeah, I mean, anecdotally, I can share that, you know, we had moved from the Cincinnati area down into Southeast Kentucky, where I'm originally from. And it was right around the time that the lockdown started happening. So both of my kids had changed schools. And then we moved into a new neighborhood, new house, and then they basically got locked in for like a full year. They kind of missed a school year.
Yep.
So their friend group has been stunted. They were very lonely and isolated. They had each other, which was great, but there even aren't even a lot of kids in my neighborhood. So like they didn't really even have play friends just to go outside. And it's been interesting to see how that has now that we've kind of, I don't know that we're actually on the other side of it, but the society has just said we are.
Right.
So we're on the other side of things, and you know, them getting into school and making friends and developing those friendships. Like it's so nice to see that, but I still wonder like what that process might have done to them in some, you know, some small way that will show itself over their life. So I guess my next question for you would be, as a parent of two kids, I have a 13-year-old and now a 12-year-old, what am I looking for to say this is normal childhood development, the stress of living, just normal lashing out because they're having a bad day versus this is something that maybe I need to look about having them see someone for?
Absolutely. So I think it's a great question. There's probably not one single answer, but I think that the framework that I try to use and that I try to talk about with caregivers is to think about what are the major arenas or areas of a young person's life that they need to be functioning in, that in order to kind of develop optimally, I think about something that I call like a developmental trajectory, right? So everybody sort of at a certain age is headed in a certain direction in terms of how they are learning about things that they need to know for school, math and reading and those kinds of things. Also, how they're developing relationships with their peers, how they're learning how to do things like be on a team with other kids their age, how they are navigating social relationships with potentially romantic interests that they might have, how they're navigating the challenges of growing up and how that changes their relationship with parents, right? So these are all normal developmental tasks. Doesn't mean that they are normally free from, you know, conflict or, you know, some negative emotions associated with that. That's all considered normal. But when you have symptoms that are causing the fundamental breakdown of one of those key areas of development and that are then potentially going to impact the developmental trajectory, those would be indications that seeking some additional input about how should I be thinking about these problems, how might I be able to access some help in order to better understand what's happening, what is my role as a caregiver in order to be able to best support my own children, and what agencies or professionals can kind of assist in this. And certainly that includes primary care providers as well as mental health providers. It also potentially can include a wider variety of individuals like teachers and school counselors, coaches. So there's a lot of different ways that depending on how a child may be having challenges in those arenas of functioning, we call it functional impairment. There's impairments in how they are functioning in important roles in their lives that they might be able to get some support for that. I'll give you an example if it's helpful.
Sure.
I think about a child who saw me. The family had to wait some time to see me. That's a challenge because getting in to see a mental health provider sometime can take some time. And so they let me know right off in the first appointment that it was something that they had considered just canceling the appointment because they had felt like things had improved a bit since they made the initial appointment. The original reason that they were seeking help was that their child had had a lot of symptoms related to difficulty getting to school. This had led to disruptions in their attendance and getting into a lot of trouble at school. The family had had a lot of conflict with their child about trying to get them to school regularly, and the school was kind of threatening truancy charges and things like that. And so the family decided that the thing that seemed easiest was to remove the child from the school and to homeschool them. Homeschooling is a choice that families absolutely make and may feel like we are best poised to provide, sometimes alone or sometimes in conjunction with other homeschooling families, to provide the best educational environment for our children. And that's a legitimate choice. In this case, it was something where the family felt cornered into providing this because they felt like we don't have any other tools in order to help our child get over this hurdle. After being taken out of the school environment, the child didn't fight with them anymore about getting to school. But there were other problems that were beginning to develop or that might cause problems down the line. They had essentially no other contact with individuals their age. The child was not being able to develop healthy friendships, relationships, participate in activities. And so they were no longer anxious about going to school, but they were facing other problems. So we think about the symptoms that they were having initially. So they were having anger outbursts. They were having problems with academic achievement and uncompleted assignments. Those were the initial problems. Those got better with the intervention that the family made, but it caused other problems in terms of functional impairment with their social relationships that were likely to have potentially long-term impacts.
Okay. Yeah, I think that, you know, just trying to think about my experiences just as a father and work in a school system, and I teach the course, like the first roadblock or issue that people face is just understanding that there is an issue.
Yeah.
Like I said, because it just, you know, is this normal behavior? Is this abnormal? Do I even have, you know, mm-hmm. everybody has different life and, you know, situations. So there may not be a person there to gauge those for everybody.
Yes.
And then the second part is, okay, I think we have an issue. What the heck can we do about it? Like, what are our options? And I know I feel very fortunate to live and work in the school system I do. We have counselors in every single school, different ways to help provide support, but not everyone has that. So just in general, is there any sort of like guidelines what resources do you think people should know about, or where would you suggest someone go to research what resources they have if they don't have the benefits of having someone in a school system, for example?
Absolutely. So I think there are different resources that people can access depending on what their concerns are. I think a very reasonable place to start and something I would encourage all families who have some concerns to do is to make sure that you have an opportunity to talk about your concerns with the child's primary care provider. One of the things that we're really trying to do is to make sure that primary care providers, and a lot is placed on their shoulders. They have a lot of responsibilities in terms of figuring out, you know, is this symptom that a child has of a medical nature something that's serious or not, and understanding and treating, you know, thousands of potential conditions. But we also are leaning on them as a source of being able to triage what is the potential seriousness of mental health conditions, mental health symptoms that young people may be having, to be able to also help counsel family members about what it is that they can do to help support the child. So, for instance, the American Academy of Pediatrics has released some guidelines that's meant to help guide pediatricians about the assessment and initial phases of treatment for depression in young people. It's a relatively common condition, one that we know responds well to treatment. Psychological treatments, and by that I mean psychotherapy or talk therapy, can be highly effective. Medications also have a role in some cases for adolescents with depression, for instance. Pediatricians may be very well poised to understand what are the initial steps in terms of assessing this. They might use, for instance, standardized scales. There's something that's called the PHQ-9, and stands for the Physician's Health Questionnaire, and there's 9 questions, and they look at some of the symptoms of depression. Using a tool like that, which has been developed and standardized for use in adolescents, allows a pediatrician to get some objective data that helps them understand next steps, what is the seriousness, how important is it. It also begins to ask questions. So there's a question in the PHQ-9 that inquires about suicidal thoughts, and that's a very important thing that we know and doesn't always get asked about in young people who may be experiencing mental health symptoms, but understanding that and picking that up when it's present could be really important in terms of understanding how best to support them, what's the level of acuity or how serious is kind of what's going on and things like that. So I do think utilizing a primary care provider is a really good, important step and resource to use as well. There are some resources that are available online as well. So The American Academy of Pediatrics has a very nice website. It's the AAP.org, which has lots of resources for caregivers about all different kinds of conditions and symptoms in pediatrics, including some mental health symptoms. The Professional Organization for Child and Adolescent Psychiatry, which is ACAP or AACAP, has its own website, AACAP.org. And there is a section there that's meant for caregivers, youth and families. And it's got some information organized through what they call facts for families. And these are basically information sheets about different kinds of conditions and then answer some of the questions that you're asking, which is like, what should I be looking for? When should I be concerned? Mm-hmm. How should I proceed here? So those are some sort of sources of information that are available on the website. I think, you know, I've been working with some other mental health providers across the state of Ohio to try to collate information about different youth mental health conditions on a website that's primarily targeted for primary care providers, although there's some parts of it that are also targeted for children and youth, and that's called OhioMindsMatter.org. And so you can kind of go through and look and read a little bit about maybe what a pediatrician might be learning about attention deficit hyperactivity disorder or depression or some other things, youth suicide, things like that. So there are information out there. I would say to folks trying to utilize the resources that are associated with national organizations within medicine is likely to result in some higher value content that has been vetted and is, you know, just not trying to sell you something also, right. Which is important.
Okay. Yeah. Very, very true. Again, just kind of quick, you know, looking back now as an adult, in particular, the training I received to do the trainings that I do, it is very clear to me that I was dealing with depression as a kid. But I did not have the vocabulary to express that, and my parents had absolutely no clue how to deal with it. Like, I had issues, didn't want to go to school, similar to the story you were sharing. I got to school, I felt bad. My stomach would hurt, and I'd come home all the time. I'd miss school. But it was because I was anxious about going there. And as I got older, and, you know, I still had those symptoms. I still today, I deal with depression on occasion, anxiety. And one of the barriers for me seeking treatment was I felt like I had the understanding that if you acknowledge that you had that, you would always, you know, be that. Because, like, if I got on medication for depression, I would have to take medication for my entire life. Turns out that's not true.
Yeah.
But it's something I believe. So if you have a parent who maybe has a child that, maybe they're borderline, maybe they're not sure, they're concerned. But like, what advice would you have for someone who has that concern that, hey, if we start seeing a therapist, my kid is now always going to be either labeled or within that system of care? Is any thoughts you have on that in general? Any advice you might share with a parent?
Absolutely. So I think the number one most important thing is that the process of treatment for mental health symptoms or a mental health condition is one that involves at least three important sort of players. There is the patient themselves, who's potentially experiencing the symptoms, having that functional impairment that I mentioned earlier. There's the caregiver. So whatever the family is for that individual, and that may be the, you know, parent or parents that are caring for them. It may be a foster family. It may even be a group home. Like, there's lots of different, it could be a grandparent, of course, lots of different ways that families can look. But it's sort of the immediate environment around that child that is supporting them. And that person, those individuals have lots and lots of information, perspective, and a real role for participating in the professional's understanding of what's going on, as well as what kinds of interventions are indicated, by which I mean are needed at this point, and also you know, how to maximize the effectiveness of that. And so as a part of that, I think participation from caregivers, and of course, the third important party in this would be the provider themselves, and sometimes that's actually multiple people. You might have you might have a primary care provider who's prescribing medication, or a child and adolescent psychiatrist who's functioning as a prescriber or as a therapist. You may have a psychologist or a social worker or a school counselor, lots of different kinds of mental health providers. I think an important thing to keep in mind is that there's a ongoing conversation, just like I would hope that people would try to have, that grownups would have with their own primary care providers about what's going on with them, what they're worried about, what their priorities are, and how they feel like as a team they can kind of best address what's going on. So, for instance, you know, around the specific concern of medications, you know, people have lots of worries about side effects that can be caused by medications, whether you'll need to take them, you know, forever, like you were alluding to. I think those are very common things. And to recognize that these are absolutely okay things to talk about with someone who's prescribing medication. And the same thing with therapy as well. Will a child that is receiving psychotherapy need to have therapy for the rest of their lives? Not necessarily at all. But having some conversations so that that the provider can know that's something that you're worried about, and they can give you more accurate information that is highly applicable to your own specific situation. I think specifically just about this, you know, question, because it's so common of a medication, is to understand that depending on the child and depending on the situation, the duration of treatment, how long you would expect to take medication, can be highly variable. We strive to prescribe medications at the lowest effective dose. And sometimes that dose is zero. So we may, for instance, prescribe a medication that is appropriate given the symptoms that a young person is suffering from. They experience dramatic improvement in those symptoms. And then we might look at sort of, well, what are some guidelines that help us figure out how long that person might be continued? So, for instance, a really common scenario would be we might see a teenager who is suffering from depression. Evaluating that depression, we decide that it's consistent with something that we call major depressive disorder, which is a diagnostic label that we apply to depression, that we would say evidence-based treatment for that is a combination of psychotherapy and sometimes, depending on the severity, medication as well. So we may prescribe those treatments. The individual begins to get psychotherapy as well as take psychiatric medications. Their functioning improves, their symptoms become much improved over the course of the treatment. And we reach a period where we say, like, you know, this person is no longer suffering from major depressive disorder. Their depression is in remission, which is great news. And then we might say, if this individual is experiencing side effects from their symptoms, then the urgency to sort of taper off the medication is particularly high. If they're not experiencing any side effects from their medication, which is honestly the most common scenario for teenagers, then we might say a standard of care would be to continue the medication treatment for approximately 12 months and then to consider a taper. And depending on the individual, we might choose to taper them or choose not to. But just having that framework, that's not something that we expect caregivers to know. That's something that I know as a child adolescent psychiatrist, because that's where my expertise is. That's what I've learned about. That's what I teach my fellows, those who are in my training program, about how to, you know, what is the standard of care for how we take care of the patients and families that we see. So if you ask those questions to your providers, you can begin to learn that information that may be able to set your mind at ease. And usually when I convey that information to patients and families, they relax a little bit, because they know that the thing that they were most worried about isn't something that's just going to automatically come to pass, that sort of beginning treatment will mean that this is a something that has to be continued for the rest of one's lives.
Again, we could probably talk for hours, but we don't have those.
Yes.
But someone in your position with your education background, if you only have 5 minutes, you have more than if you need it. But I'm saying, like, what is like the one thing that you wish you could just tell everyone or repeat to everyone or make people truly understand that you think would help just in general improvement in either education, awareness, or implementation of mental health policies in our world?
Absolutely. So I think at the caregiver level, right, to understand as a parent is that it's a tough role to be a parent. You are responsible for lots of different aspects of trying to understand what's going on in your child's life, to weather with them the developmental challenges. It's not easy to face some of the challenges socially and academically and otherwise that a person faces. And so cultivating relationships with young people, with your child, which allow you to talk about how people are experiencing and conveying that you are ready to listen to what they have to say. This is your number one most important tool as a caregiver. And I talk to lots of family members who are very good at this or are really interested in cultivating this and really excited about learning new ways that they might be able to do this effectively. I think that the number one most important thing is assigning value to it, right? Sort of saying like me being able to try to become attuned with my child, entertaining new ways of learning how to do that effectively, I think can be really helpful. And to be able to then think about what are some arenas of challenge and functional impairment that I'm seeing. So I'm seeing that my child is having a great deal of trouble with school right now, and I can see how much that's impacting them. So then being able to kind of, you know, put your finger on like, this is where I think that they need some more support. And if I'm a little bit out of tools or ideas about how to correct it myself, then that's where trying to shore up some additional support from other individuals can be helpful. Again, it can be, you know, it could be, let's say it was an academic area that you think your child is most struggling, really trying to partner with a teacher or asking the school to do an evaluation of the child's learning needs. So for instance, this may not be super well known to everyone, but in the United States, every parent, every caregiver is entitled to request that their school perform an evaluation of the child's learning needs to find out if they need accommodations for special education, if they have a learning disability or other things like that. And that can be the first step in order to really understand what's going on, what are the needs that my child has and things like that. Working, as I mentioned before, with your primary care provider to try to, get their take on things, they can help you sort of understand the next steps. So to summarize again, like cultivating like a connection where you are, where your child has some sense of safety that they will be able to let you into their world a little bit, which, you know, is they'll never fully let you into their world and let you know everything. But then being able to tap into other resources that may be around you so that you can help understand better and understand best next steps for addressing your child's needs.
Only tangentially related, but something you said spurred into my head, because you also mentioned earlier about the young person that was having struggles with school and started homeschooling. That is something you as a parent, caregiver, or that are listening are struggling with, at least in Kentucky, because that's where I live, The school that I work at, we manage the CAPA program for our school district, which is a homeschooling program, but they're still, the students are still enrolled in a school, which is ours. They are issued a Chromebook because that's what everyone in the world gets now these days. And they still have schoolwork. They still have a coach or an educator that works with them. They have check-in times, but they basically don't come to the building. So it's not homeschooling like you, the caregiver, are responsible to be the teacher. It's still the same schoolwork they would do if they were there, but they can do it on their own schedule. Like we have students who, you know, they start doing their schoolwork at 3 p.m. and go till 8 p.m. because that fits their lifestyle or whatever. So there are other educational avenues out there. If homeschooling, if you're worried, like I don't want to homeschool, like there's no way I would be able to do that. But that also doesn't mean that that's the only option. I teach them or they go to a school. There are some other options available. And I'm sure across the states there are others, but I know CAPA is our program that we manage for our school district.
Yeah, I'm so glad you brought that up. I think it's important to understand that actually there are really valuable and effective ways to support the education of children outside of the traditional school, in school, in building environment. And what you mentioned is definitely one of them. And I think that being able to kind of tap into programs that are well designed, that really have taken the time to understand what are the different needs academically, socially, and so forth of the individuals who are receiving their education that way, and partnering with the school can a lot of times help you navigate those, understand and anticipate what might the challenges be, what might be challenges that you would face, and then from there being able to kind of anticipate them, head them off at the pass, that kind of a thing. So yeah, I definitely didn't want to come off as overly critical of schooling options other than the very traditional one. But also, it's really useful if you can understand what can I anticipate might be some ways in which that choice about school is going to impact my child. Mm-hmm. How can I mitigate any potential barriers that may be coming up to their development?
And I think it comes down to a lot of avenues in life that there are resources out there. You probably aren't aware of them.
Yeah.
So there are ways to help find them. And again, all the different websites and organizations you mentioned, I will put in the show notes to make it easy for people to find. And then I guess we have someone else we've got scheduled that's going to come on and talk specifically about self-care, because I think that's important for adults and youth. So I don't want to spend a lot of time on that, but do you have anything about self-care that you would want maybe caregivers to know when interacting with their children?
Absolutely. So one of the most common things that I hear, and I think is good advice and one that is, it kind of makes you smile a little bit, is to think about the process, many aspects of taking care of your child as the instructions that you get when you're on an airplane. When they talk to you about the fact that, like, if there is a loss of cabin pressure, the oxygen masks may fall, what is the one thing that they always tell you? They say,
put yours on first.
Make sure that you have your own mask on before you turn to help your child. I don't know that I would say before, but I would say certainly at the same time as understanding what your child's mental health needs are, what ways that they can benefit from support. It's really important to keep in mind that as a caregiver, your ability to take care of your child is going to be directly impacted by how you're doing. And that's hard because there may be many factors that are impacting how you yourself are doing that are out of your control. They may be related to your financial situation. They may be related to the stress of your job. They may be related to conflict with your family or difficulty navigating a variety of different social relationships. They may be due to challenges related to safety in your neighborhood. All of those things can impact. But I think really being attuned to how well am I able to deal with what is predictably going to be the ups and downs of the experience of being a caregiver, because my child is gonna be crying at times. My child is going to have tantrums at times. My child is going to get in fights or get in trouble at school or other things like that. And so being able to navigate those things most effectively with your child requires a degree of self-awareness and self-care that is more challenging for people who are stressed beyond their level. So while we might say, well, it'd be better if it was less stressed, that is not helpful advice for anybody.
Right, yes.
And so instead we would think about the paradigm of, given the fact that your stress level is high, given the fact that the objective barriers to you being able to be your best version of yourself are significant right now, what are some best ways that you can mitigate that, that you can cope with, that you can overcome, in particular in the ways that those things impact your ability to parent or be a caregiver? So just as an example, I think that many people, when they are more stressed, that they become more irritable, right? I have a shorter fuse when I am highly stressed. It means I'm more likely to respond sharply to my spouse, to my own children, and things like that. And so having tools to help navigate that, having an understanding of like, oh, this is the best way that I can proceed in those situations so that I preserve the relationship and the mental health of the people I care about around me. And it doesn't mean that I'm never going to sort of snap at them, but it does mean that I have maybe an understanding of how can I work to try to repair and make sure that there's a foundation feeling cared about and safe in that parent-child relationship with my own children. And also, how can I ensure that I am modeling for them that I am trying to be aware of my own emotional states, that I'm trying to take care of them, and that I care about the emotional experiences that they have. And if I say something that hurts their feelings, that matters to me. As a father, that's something that I take seriously, and I want to try to help mitigate. So those are some ways that I think about it.
Well, once again, thank you so much for your time today. I know you're very busy, and I just really appreciate you offering some time. So just any final thoughts, anything that I didn't ask today that you were hoping I would, or just anything else that's kind of come up throughout the conversation that you'd like to leave our listeners with before we sign off?
I think one thing that I think about is, I started off maybe the conversation on a bit of a gloomy note, talking about sort of the fact that there's a significant mental health crisis, that, you know, the acuity of things is perhaps greater now than was in the past. But what I would like to emphasize is that I see things that make me very hopeful for the future. I think, as you alluded to, that there is a more of a conversation about mental health, particularly among the youth in our country, now than there ever has been in the past. If you talk with young people about their awareness of things like mental health conditions, there is less and less stigma associated with it. Still significant amounts of stigma, but it is more commonplace for there to be a conversation about things like having depression, having anxiety, having even suicidal thoughts. And being able to have conversations allows people to get access to care more than they had been in the past. When these things are terribly secret and can never be uttered, then that means that people are suffering in silence. And so I see a lot of indications that this is a culture that is slowly changing in this country for the better, that that our young people and their caregivers are more and more understanding what mental health is, what are some ways that are important to promote it? And what are some signs that things are not as they should be and that some help is needed? So I think, you know, because I know that a significant amount of the audience of this podcast are people that are, they're on the front lines. They're providing youth mental health first aid. Just to say that your role is very important, because I think that more than ever, young people are ready to reach out for help and to communicate things about what's going on with them that will allow them to accept help. And I think this is, you know, this is something that I feel like is a huge boon for our country and for our future.
So I know usually when we talk from our other podcasts and stuff, you always like to mention the Trevor Project. If you'd like to touch on that before we sign off.
Absolutely. So there are many organizations that promote youth mental health that are very worthy. One of my personal favorite or kind of most significant organization is one that's called the Trevor Project. The Trevor Project is a nonprofit that is set up as a crisis organization that can be reached by youth who identify as LGBTQ, so queer youth, which they define as up to age 25. It's a wonderful organization that has resources including crisis lines to call on your phone or to text or even to sort of access via chat on the website. And I think that when I've talked with many youth who identify as queer, one of the things that they've told me over and over is that it's very hard to access a mental health system where you don't know what kind of reception you're going to get from the person that you talk to, that you reach out to for help. Right. And feeling like that might not be a safe environment, a safe call to make, is a very hard thing. And so one of the things that I really love about the Trevor Project is that it's absolutely dedicated to make this a very safe space for people who are in crisis in the LGBTQ community, that they can reach out for help. And so I have personally spoken to many young people who felt like this was an invaluable resource for them. And so when I can, I try to promote their mission. I think it's a great organization.
As we bring this week's episode to a close, I just want to once again say thank you to Brian. I really appreciated him giving me some time today and sharing about his experiences and his knowledge around mental health, and particularly child and adolescent mental health. I hope you've enjoyed this episode. I hope you've gotten something from it. Please do check out the show notes for links to some of those valuable resources we touched on. And I hope you'll come back and join us next week when we have another amazing guest on to chat with. As another reminder, of course, if you are interested in becoming a service member, or if you have questions around serving, or perhaps your organization would like to become a host site, you will find information and links to follow in our show notes.